Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 38 today. It seems to be a break in the story about Joseph. But there have been several theories of why this chapter about some of the problems that Judah encountered is included here in the history of Jacob. The first theory is that it begins to delineate the tribe of Judah that, of course, is going to be so important in the line of the Messiah. But the other theory is just the opposite. It says that it shows the degradation that occurred in the tribes after Joseph was sold into slavery. Now, with that wide of interpretation, I'm sure we can't be 100% sure, but it's a very interesting chapter. It's somewhat like Rebecca and Jacob tricking Isaac, in the sense that most people are very negative about the methods they used. I really think that Rebecca, because of God's revelation to her, was trying to fulfill what God had told her earlier. Now, I agree that her methods and Jacob's methods were inappropriate. Now, I feel the same way about Tamar in this chapter. She is a Canaanite woman. I think that's significant that she's going to be the line of the Messiah is going to come through her, as we learn from both Matthew 1:3 and Luke 3:33. Now, I think her motives were good, and I think her methods were questionable. But again, it's an interesting chapter, and I think you'll enjoy studying it with me. Let's start at verse 1, if we could, then. And it came about at that time that Judah departed. Now, there's been much question, why did Judah leave? Was he mad at his brothers for selling Joseph? Did this occur immediately after they sold Joseph? Those questions we can't answer. You might want to see Deuteronomy 33:7 for a parallel passage about the departing from his brothers, and visited a certain Adullamite whose name is Hira. Now, this Adullamite is going to be a very famous cave where David is going to catch Saul later on. It's in the tribal allocation of Judah. Now, when it says visited a certain, it seems he's made a partnership, a permanent residence. He moved away from his brothers, moved to the south. Some say the reason that Judah had to be reunited with his brothers, that's mentioned in Deuteronomy 33:7, is because he had become infiltrated with Canaanite influence and later had to be reunited. I'm not sure that's true. It does show that very early Judah settled in this very area that will be his tribal allocation later on. Now, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite. Man, if there's ever been love at first sight in the Bible, this is it. It's as good as Rebecca, you know, and Isaac the first time they saw. He saw her and he wanted her. Now, is the problem that he married Canaanite women? Well, it doesn't seem to be criticized here. Matter of fact, this Canaanite, his wives are going to bear him three sons. And he's going to choose a wife for one of his oldest son. It's going to be Tamar. Apparently a very godly lady, though a Canaanite. But it does show that isn't it amazing how many irregularities there are in the genealogy of Christ? I think it's a kind of a backdoor way of God saying, I love all people. We got Rahab, the Canaanite prostitute. We got Ruth, the Moabitess. We got Tamar, you know, a Canaanite wife that's been really cheated by her father-in-law and one of her brothers-in-laws. It's a kind of a gross story, but she's the heroine of this, I want to tell you. Whose name was Shua. Now, notice the wife's name's not mentioned. That may be a way of depreciating the Canaanite wife. We're just not sure. And he took her and went into her. And she conceived and bore a son and named him Ur. And then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. And she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Cherib's that she bore him. Now, the rabbis make a big deal about the supposed name of this location. But I think it's more rabbinical hermeneutics than it is good exegesis, so I have ignored it. Now, Judah took a wife for his firstborn. Notice that he took his own wife. He didn't let his father have a choice in that. But now he goes back to the cultural kind of ways in which he would choose the wives for his children. He also chose a Canaanite woman. It shows that the people of God were immersed in the Canaanite culture. And really, it's going to show that their going down into Egypt is going to be a blessing, because the Egyptians hated shepherds. And they thought they were better than these other foreigners, and it was a way of segregating the Hebrews and keeping them from any foreign influence. So really, the sojourn in Egypt is going to become a blessing. Now notice where it says, and so he took a wife for his firstborn and named her Tamar. Now the word there means palm tree, okay? But Judah's firstborn was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. You might want to compare Proverbs 10:27, talks about a short life for those who are wicked. Now then it mentions, if people say, well, what was the sin of Well, the very same phrase, he did evil in the sight of the Lord took his life, is going to be used for the second son here, Onan. Now, it's obvious what the second son does, and some have said that also didn't want his wife to get pregnant, wanted to keep her attractive, I guess no stretch marks or something, and that's why the Lord took his life, because he didn't really want children. Now, that's rabbinical, and I'm not sure we can and hold to that. So, he dies, whatever he did, the Lord took his life early. And so Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up an offspring for your brother. Now this goes back to the Levirate marriage law. Apparently, it came long before the Mosaic covenant. Here we are back in Judah's time. Now, basically it must have been something that all the cultures knew because of the significance of keeping a person's lineage goings in the older parts of the Old Testament. The afterlife was almost caught up in a man's posterity. Now, this is in Deuteronomy 25, verses 5 and following, where it's explained. The only two accounts in the Bible we really have of this are Ruth and this account right here. So the father said, go in. The son didn't argue with him, but the son really didn't want to raise up an heir for his brother. His brother was the firstborn. That means his brother would have got most of the inheritance. For apparently selfish reasons, he did not want to have a child. Now, if you just read through this in English, it seems in verse 9 that Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. Now, the word when here and the Tyndale commentary in the Old Testament, a very good commentary, reminds us that it's whenever. He went in sexually to his sister-in-law several times and did this same act several times. So he's really taken advantage of her. He's taken advantage of his father because his father thinks he's trying to raise up a child. And all this time he's premeditatively taking sexual advantage but without fulfilling the purpose of Levirate marriage. Apparently God was angry with this and took his life too. Look at verse 10. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, remain a widow in your father's house. Now we know this is somewhat cultural. We find this same concept in Leviticus 22:13 for a priest daughter, and also in Ruth chapter 1 verse 8 in connection with what Ruth said to her daughter-in-law. So maybe it was a cultural element that a widow went back to her parents' house. It seems from the context that Judah implies that when his youngest son gets old enough, he will give her him to her also to raise up a child. Until my son Shelah grows up, for he thought, I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers. Now here's the problem with Judah. Judah felt like this woman had some kind of curse on her. He had lost two of his three sons to her. He only had one son left. He was afraid to send it in to this Canaanite woman. Now it's ironical here because his only son left, the line of the Messiah is in jeopardy. And just like Abraham and all the other patriarchs try to manipulate to get God's will done, Judah's going to do this too. He's afraid to trust in God's promises, so he's going to kind of say, no, I'm afraid to give my only son, my youngest son, to this woman. The other boys are dead, so I'm just not going to do it. I'll tell her I will, but I really don't plan on doing it. So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now, after a considerable time, Shelah's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. Now, it's interesting that Judah was apparently monogamous, apparently had great love for this Canaanite girl, didn't have any multiple wives or concubines. But after her death, and apparently he was very much in love with her, he mourned. But then he went to the time of sheep shearing. Now notice it mentions in verse 12, Judah went up to with his sheep shearers to Timnah. Now this is the same name of the village where Samson, of course, had a lot of his exploits. Some say there are two Timnahs. But I think that's probably a bit much. They're very close together in the Sheplah, or lower rolling hills of Judah. So the sheep shearing time apparently was a real party time. You can see that probably from 1 Samuel 25, 4 and 36. That's in connection with David and Naboth and Abigail. And you can see how it was a real party time there in that context. and he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. So they were going to a party, okay? And it was told to Tamar, "Behold, your father-in-law is going to Timnah to shear sheep." She knew what that meant. So she removed her widow's garments and covered herself with a veil. This is very interesting, this veil. We learn from some Assyrian documents that this veil was a sign of a married woman who was participating in a cultic prostitution. From other passages, we know that in Babylon, this was a symbol of Ishtar, the veiled love goddess. So apparently this veil meant something. Now, you know, even in our culture, we still have a veil. The bride is veiled at the wedding. And I bet most of us don't know the historical origin of that. It's something to do with the ideal of submission and respect, but exactly how it came to be, we're not certain. The same is true of the use of veils in the Bible. There's not very many veils. Moses wore a veil when the glory began to fade when he went up on Mount Sinai. Rebekah has a veil when she meets Isaac. Here Tamar has a veil, but there are not too many other veils mentioned in the Bible. So it's a cultural thing, but what exactly it means, we're just not certain. And she wrapped herself and sat in the gateway. Now, this city, we're not sure where it is. There's been much speculation. But anyway, it must have been a crossroads on the way to Timnah. Apparently, Judah was enough used to Horlot sitting at these crossroads that he recognized what she was doing there. Now, apparently, she had a tent with her or some way. I don't know how exactly they did it, but apparently she had a tent and was sitting in front of it. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought that she was a harlot. Now, there are two different words for harlot. The word here used in verse 15 is the common word for a harlot, a prostitute. But the word used in verses 21 and 22, now it's used by the Adullamite, Judah's friend, it means a cultic prostitute. Now, whether Judah thought she was a cultic prostitute or whatever, his wife was dead. And in his day, there was an obvious double standard. He apparently felt no religious qualms about going to this prostitute. For Judah's sake, I hope it was a common prostitute and not a fertility goddess worship. But we just don't know from the text, because that's what the term his friend is going to use. Now, Judah saw her, thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Hear now, let me come into you." What's bothered commentators is Judah knew the right things to say. For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" And he said, "Therefore I will send you a kid." Now, there's been some speculation about that a kid may have been the normal price for a harlot. Now, we get that from Samson bringing a kid to his Philistine wife, from Judges 15:1. Some say, from very older accounts, that a kid was a symbol of the love goddess. And maybe that was the normal price. We're just not sure about that. But a kid was agreed on. He was going to shear his sheep, so he would have one available. She said, moreover, "Will you give me a pledge until you send it?" Now, friends, she had this planned out. She knew what she wanted. She wanted something from Judah that was uniquely recognizable as belonging only to him. So look what she asked for. And she said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said to him, "Your seal and your cord and your staff." Now, this seal, some say it's a signet ring. But I think the word here, because the word cord is mentioned, it seems like it's a necklace. Now, we know from Babylon, and some examples in Egypt, but mostly Babylon, that most of the men of any renown or wealth at all carried around their neck as a symbol of their affluence a round seal. And instead of signing their name, they would roll this seal across the document. And they were inscribed individually for every person. So Judah apparently had his own. Now, whether it was a Babylonian seal, as I think, around his neck, or a signet ring around his neck, I'm not sure. But it was uniquely his. Now, the staff, again, we don't know a whole lot from ancient history. There's a lot of gaps in our knowledge. But it seems that men carried a staff, kind of like a Britishers carry an umbrella. And every staff, the head of that staff, was uniquely carved for that individual person. Now, she asked for something that Judah would recognize as his and no one else's. Now, apparently, the guy was lonesome because he shouldn't have been able to give that much to her. They were very personal things that he needed, and yet he was willing to let her have them. So he gave them to her and went into her, and she conceived by him. Now, that's not by accident, friend, this one-shot deal, and she's pregnant. The hand of God's in this. I think Tamar knew the hand of God. She's more concerned about fulfilling her right to her to the eldest son of Judah than Judah is. Now, so she arose and departed and removed her veil and put on her widow's garments. Then Judah sent the kid by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand. He did not find her. And he asked the men of the place, saying, "Where is the temple prostitute?" There's the different name. "Who is by the road?" But they said, "There has been no temple prostitute there." So he returned to Judah and said, "I did not find her." And furthermore, the men of the place said, "There had been no temple prostitute there." And Judah said, "Let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock." Now again, Judah's motives are not too cool. He said, "I tried to pay her and she wasn't there. We can't ask too many questions. Everybody will know what I did." Apparently there still was some cultural shadiness to what he did, because he didn't want to tell many folks that he had done this, right? Now it came about 3 months later that Judah was informed that his daughter-in-law Tamar had played the harlot, and behold, she was also with child by harlotry. Now the word harlotry is plural here. Implication is, she's been making love with somebody over and over and finally got pregnant. Well, that does seem to be the logical thing. How many people make love one time and get pregnant? There is some, but not very many. So the word, they're assuming she had lived in unfaithfulness for a long time. Now, Judah, being the head of the clan, was responsible for all the legal affairs of the clan. So that's why they went to him. Then Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burned." Now, this is a double standard, isn't it? And there is one in the Old Testament, not in the New, but in the Old. It seems there's no condemnation for a man going to a prostitute, but a woman having an affair is worthy of death. Now, I agree that's unfair, but this is an ancient world. Be careful not to judge the ancient world in light of our cultural mores, because, friends, we got some pretty bad areas, too. So, there's a double standard. That's obvious. Now, the burning is unusual, for in the Mosaic legislation, it's only the daughter of a priest that is burned for committing harlotries. Other women who are caught unfaithful are stoned to death, which is... I know they're both ways to kill you, but burning is a lot more severe. You might want to compare Deuteronomy 22:20 through 24 and Leviticus 21:9 for that, okay? Just as a little sideline, burning of an unfaithful wife is mentioned in the Code of Hammurabi for a little different offense, but a related offense. You might want to compare that. So it was something cultural. Judah wasn't making it far-fetched. It was something that his day was accustomed to for infidelity. And it was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law saying, now some say that she waited to the last minute. Others say no, she waited to the most public moment, the most dramatic moment. Now I'm really not sure which it is. It seems to me this lady really took her life in her hand. First of all, she degraded herself by going in to her father-in-law. And she seemed to do it only for the purpose of having a child that was legally due her, that the seed might come through her. She was willing to risk her life, risk her reputation, even risk her unborn child. Now, friend, that's going pretty far. And apparently it was for religious motives. I don't know what else it could have been for, because Judah never goes into her again. She does not become his wife or anything. So it's just one time for the purpose of an heir. So at this very dramatic moment, she says, "Send and ask Judah who these belong to. Please examine and see whose signet ring." Now this signet ring is the translation here in verse 25. But because of the word card earlier, there is some difference of opinion about should it be a Babylonian circular seal or a signet ring more common in Canaan. And it could be either one. Well, obviously, Judah recognized them. Look at verse 26. And said, "She is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son, Shelah." Now, there's not too much righteousness to go around this chapter, to tell you the truth. All he's really saying is he's not claiming that they're both spiritual. What he is saying, she came across better than me. Her motives are better. Her intent's better. and I think her religious purposes are better than Judah. Now, Judah is not acting any different than the other men of his day, but you certainly can see the Canaanite influence, because I tell you what, when we pick up the story of Joseph in 39 and 40, his sexual attitudes are far different than Judah's. He won't make love to Potiphar's wife because he would be sinning against God. Implication, the sexual act with someone outside your wife is a sin against God. Now, Judah has no qualms going into a prostitute. Now, I agree that Judah only had one wife and was very faithful to her, apparently, until she died. But it is a contrast here in the two. So I wouldn't think Judah comes across very righteous in this deal either. Now, and it came about at the time she was giving birth that, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now, this is very, very similar to what happened, of course, to Rebekah. Now, it doesn't mention the war in her womb here, but I tell you what, there is a problem at birth, and one child apparently is going to be the firstborn, and they mark him with a red string, but the other child burst out of the womb first. Now, that's something of the tension you see back in Rebekah. It's interesting to me that most of these early patriarchs' wives are barren, and several of them, when they do have children, have twins. Now, you say, well, that just shows it's one story that's been elaborated several times. No, I don't think that at all. I think that it's more cultural, more normal in that day, apparently. Now, so there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place that while she was giving birth, one put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread to his hand, saying, this one came out first. Now, the rabbinical theology was the first to break the womb was the firstborn. It's obvious there are problems in this childbirth, because normally one of the baby's head comes first, and here's a hand. Now, this scarlet thread, there's been much discussion here. Some say it was a cultic practice of the day, because obviously the midwife is a Canaanite. Boy, I wish I knew what to do with this, because it seems like this red thread is going to be woven through parts of the Mosaic writing. There's going to be the red rope put around one of the scapegoats, Leviticus 16. There's going to be the Canaanite prostitute's going to put a red rope out our house. I want to say it's a symbol of redemption. You know, I see that. And yet, as an interpreter wanting to hold to the historical grammatical principles, I'm not sure I can read that into this passage without doing damage to the passage. I'd like to, but I'm not sure I can. But it came about as he drew his hand back, and behold, his brother came out. And then she said, what a breach you have made for yourself. So he is named Perez, which apparently is a popular etymology to the term breach, or to break through. Now remember, these Bible names are never technical etymologies. They are popular etymologies based on the similar sounds of certain words. And that's true even of the covenant name for God. The covenant name for God in Exodus 3:14 is not spelled exactly like the Hebrew verb to be. But it's close. It sounds close. And the same is true of most of these names in the Bible. And afterwards, his brother came out who had a scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was Zerah. And then we move right back in to the life of Joseph. Well, I wish I knew exactly why this chapter was seemingly burst in the context here. It's obvious there is a theological purpose because it's so out of place. Again, I'm not sure if it's negative or positive. If it's negative, it's showing how quickly these boys of faith got away from the faith of their fathers. If it is positive, it's trying to document the lineage of the Messiah in the tribe of Judah, but also, I think, theologically, it is showing very early there's no such thing as a pure racial Jew. That the line of the Messiah is full of mixed blood and strange events and all kinds of wild historical things. It's a good example, I think, again, of apparently Tamar knowing somehow, I don't know if it's through prophecy or Judah told her of all the things that had happened to his ancestors. But apparently she recognizes something about Judah that's significant and sees her place in this lineage scheme. She's mentioned, like I said, in both Matthew 1 and Luke 3. I think that the lady has great faith. I have defended these last three lessons, as you know, Rebekah and Jacob against Isaac and Esau. And I think I'm going to defend Tamar against Judah. I think she's the heroine. I think Judah was trying to manipulate, as all these other men did, how to get God's will done. And every time we do that, we cause the pits of historical situation. But aren't you glad God still worked through these men, even though they tried in very foolish ways to bring about His will in their lives? Friends, the Old Testament to me is nothing more than the faithfulness of God and the unfaithfulness of man. If God can have patience with men like the patriarchs in Judah, God can have patience with us. It would seem the line of the Messiah should come through Joseph. He's the faithful one. He's the godly one. He's the pure one. Matter of fact, I really think in my study of the Bible, the only two people that nothing bad is said about is Joseph and Jesus. But the line comes through Judah. I heard a preacher say one time, God hits a pretty good lick with a crooked stick. If that's true, friend, He can use us. He's going to use a Canaanite lady who hadn't been treated fairly, but with great faith. He's going to use Judah, who does a apparently cultural thing, but still probably inappropriate thing, because he's ashamed that he doesn't want to talk about it. And yet God used him. God will use you if you give your life to Him. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.